He held it ever since.
This is a interview with Lieutenant General R.J. Lane by Dr. R.H. Roy and Chris Main. The date is May the 11th, 1978, and this is the third interview.
Now, where did we... Well, we left off where I was talking about my arrival at 35 Squadron at Linton on Ouds in Yorkshire, and that Cheshire was my flight commander, and he had taken me for my first trip in Halifax, and we had he had damaged the undercarriage in the takeoff, and we had a small accident when we landed. But as I mentioned, it was on a grass field, and so there wasn't too much damage done to the airplane. But Cheshire was embarrassed to tears. That's the only way to describe it. A man of his background to have bent an airplane, a brand new airplane, because the Halifaxes, these were Halifax Mark 1s, and 35 Squadron was one of the first bomber squadrons to be equipped with a, with the new four-engine Halifax bomber to replace the Whitley that, that was on the squadron. They actually had Whitleys on the squadron, although I never again flew in a Whitley after having left my operational training unit where I trained on them, thank God.
You just mentioned one of your clippings from the scrapbook that you also flew Wellington.
That's false. Yep, no, that was typical newspaper misrepresentation. Well, when... of course, the first thing to do was to be crewed up, in the sense that I had arrived as a pilot, inexperienced, and I did not have a crew. I was, as in those days, you were sent to a squadron and then you joined up with a crew, which is what happened to me. And I was crewed with a sergeant pilot, an RAF sergeant pilot by the name of Williams, a very small chap. And I became his second pilot. So what happened, of course, in that October after I'd arrived at the squadron, there were various flights in the Halifax to do such things as air firing, some night flying. For me, all I did was sit there, and I did what I was told by the pilot. The pilot could actually fly the airplane himself, but the idea of having a second pilot was to twofold. One, of course, most important, to gain experience. And then secondly, if there was an emergency or the pilot should be hurt or injured or like that, that there was somebody else who could take over. But you had to go through the whole drill, though, of understanding the airplane. So I spent quite a bit of time learning about the airplane, the various systems on the airplane, the emergency procedures, the crew drills, everything that would be associated with an operation or flying an aircraft of that complexity. And in those days, it was a fairly complex airplane. And there were many, many types of emergencies. What to do if it, in case of engine failure, what to do if you lost two engines on one side. Would the airplane fly, for example? Little tricks like not turning, if you did lose two engines on one side, or even an outer on one side, you never turned into that engine, because if you did, you had so much power on the other side that once you got your wing up, you'd have a hell of a time getting your wing down without pulling all your power off. In other words, the airplane wanted to take control of itself, and the first thing you knew, you could be in deep trouble, and that happened to several people. And a little later, I'll record an incident of that nature that was very tragic. But those were that was sort of the training that you were taking while you were actually on an operational crew.
Well, and Reg, what about bombing? You know, when...
Yes, well, by then, we got to the point where I was with an experienced pilot.
Yeah.
This Sergeant Williams had, I don't know how many trips he'd had when I arrived at the squadron, but he was an experienced pilot. So we would go out and do two... practice bombing ranges, and there were several all over England. You were allocated the time, And you would call up on RT if you came over the range, and then you would drop these small, and they were 11-pound practice bombs, and they just made a little puff when they went off.
Mm-hmm.
But on a proper range where they have the various what are the things that take the sighting on the puff, and so they knew exactly where your bomb had gone.
Oh, yeah.
And what error you had in your bomb. But it was only I never actually was flying the airplane when this was going on. This was all being done by the experienced captain, and of course with his navigator. In those days we didn't have bomb aimers. The navigator wore two hats. He was not only the navigator, but he became the bomb aimer as well. When we got in on the target, he would be the one who would leave his navigation table and go and lie on his belly in the front of the airplane with a bomb sight and do the run-in and give directions to the pilot.
Really, at that time, it's a bomb aimer navigator who's really responsible for...
Absolutely.
And he is telling the pilot what to do.
That's right. So what he has to do, the navigator would basically get the airplane to the target, so the target was visual. In other words, you could see the target.
Mm-hmm.
Or you would drop flares and light up the target, and then do a circuit and come around in again, by which time he was on the bomb site. By that time he would have put the wind factor onto the bomb site, the speed, all the various factors, basically it's a physics thing, what was required so that the bomb site would make all the corrections that were necessary to put the bomb on the target. So he would do that. Thus, we went through several things. One other thing we used to do, too, in those days was the Halifax Mark I being so very new, we weren't too damn sure what the consumption was, that is, fuel consumption.
Yeah.
So we had to do several fairly long cross-countries to actually do fuel consumption, to test the consumption at various settings, power settings, on the engine. And at various altitudes. So there was a fair amount of experimental work really going on with a new airplane as well as using it on an operational sense. Well, this was all very, very new to me. I did my first night flying trip with Williams on the 24th of October, and which I remember was just a straight, simple night flying trip. I wasn't in control of the airplane. I didn't even touch a control, so I was nothing untoward for me. And then we get into November when I did my first operation, and that was November the 7th. There was Sergeant Williams, myself, and 5 others. There'd be a navigator, an engineer, and gunners. We had, of course, the tail gunner, the mid-upper gunner, and the front gunner. So that the crew, in this case, were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, there were 7 in the crew. And that first trip was to Berlin, and which was a good introduction for me.
How many bombs would the aircraft carry?
A trip like that, I would think we would probably have a bomb load of about 8,000 pounds. In other words, 8 1,000-pound bombs. Although, quite often we had mixtures. There may have been 2 1,000-pound bombs and several racks of incendiaries.
Mm-hmm.
The 4-pound incendiary, which was a pretty vicious damn little bomb.
You would have nothing to say about the mix that was being carried. That would be decided by whom?
It was decided by Bomber Command. The organization would be that when a raid was laid on, and the Commander-in-Chief of Bomber Command in the morning would make his decision as to whether there would be a raid that night. Now, weather would be number one concern. Not only weather over Europe or over Germany, but weather back home for the return flight, as well as takeoff. So you had 2 factors to consider. If the weather was going to be really foul over the continent, there was no point in going. You could these people, because he had a bad front with icing conditions in it. So while they didn't know, again, we didn't know too much about icing in those days. But weather was terribly important. The other thing was what was the state, the operational state in the command? Had they been doing two raids? Were there a lot of unserviceable airplanes? In other words, could he scramble enough airplanes together to make a raid worthwhile? And that related to the priority bomb list, the target list that he had been given by the Air Ministry. And it was all in a priority. The importance of a particular target, whether he would go or not. In other words, all these factors were weighed up by the commander-in-chief at a morning briefing and discussion. And then he would make his decision. And if it was okay, we go tonight. Then the word would go out to the various groups in Bomber Command. And at that time, there was 1 group, 3 group, 4 group, and 5 group. So there were the 4 bomber groups, each headed up by an Air Vice Marshal. And they were scattered geographically from Yorkshire, which was 4 group, down all down through England, down to just north of London, which was, as I recall, 3 groups. Area, maybe 1 group. Well, then, at the group headquarters, the commander, or the AOC of that group, the air officer commanding of the group, would receive word from Bomber Command headquarters that there was to be a raid, and he would receive the code word for that particular target, so he would know what it was. Well, when that happened, of course, the whole machine went into high gear. The Met people, all the group Met, senior Met officers in the groups would discuss with the senior, with the Met officer at Bomber Command. They'd have a conference to try and reach agreement on the weather. Now, weather forecasting was terribly difficult because there were no ships out in the Atlantic. The weather was always coming in from the Atlantic. It was only when the odd time when they put out a meteorological flight out into the Atlantic, they get any real reading. Any ships out there maintained wireless silence, so that there was no way of getting weather reports in from the Atlantic. And other than from Iceland and from Newfoundland, that was where your last weather reports were coming from. And from there on, it was by guess and by God for the Met people. And all they literally had were the islands, the British Isles, to get their various pressure readings and winds and so forth to try and come up with any forecast. So that, and then once that weather passed, they had no idea what happened to it once it hit the continent. Although, of course, they had a better idea, and a few Met flights there would help start up.
Yeah.
But that, I want to use that as an example of how the one of the many organizations would go to work to try and get ready for that particular night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you asked about bombs. Another one would be the armament organization. And the armament organization at Bomber Command would decide that on that particular target, it had a lot of, for the sake of argument, a lot of old wooden buildings, and therefore incendiaries should be the larger percentage or proportion of the bomb loads.
Yeah.
They always threw in bombs, never was an entirely incendiary load, they always threw in bombs so people would have to keep their heads down.
Right.
In other words, to try and keep
pitch.
That's right.
Yeah.
Keep the firefighting
yeah.
people
right.
With their heads down.
Didn't they use the 4,000 pounds?
That came later.
That came much later.
Yeah. At that time we were only using 1,000 pounders and 500 pound bombs, plus these incendiaries. Well, there was the armors even went sort of tried to sort out the ammunition that should be put in the guns. Turrets, tracer ammunition and armor-piercing ammunition and so forth, all depending on what kind of opposition was expected. The navigation people got together. They had to sort out what route was going to be flown. And we knew where the target was. Well, how are you going to get there?
Well, that, again, your navigation people, that'd be at the top level.
That's at the very top, the Bomber Command.
Yeah.
Bomber Command would lay on the route. Then there would be a discussion, a conference, and these were all done over telephones with scramblers. On the route, was each group happy with the route? And earlier on in the war, this was never a contentious issue. But later, when Pathfinders came back, it became, there were some awful arguments about routing. And again, I can come on to that later. the route was terribly important because it there was a weather on the route, the flak defenses on the route, the fighter organization, the night fighter organization on the route, and the wind conditions over the target. You always try to go downwind so that you get through the target area quickly. In other words, your ground speed would be higher, as opposed to coming in on the target upwind. So the actual bomb run was always, they always tried to lay on the route so that your bomb run was downwind. So there had to be a forecast of what was the wind to be at the time of arrival over the target. And then associated with the route, of course, was the height to be flown. Because, again, while it wasn't so important in the early days, it became terribly important later, the fear of collision. And each group was allocated a space. You know, just like we have space control, altitude control today in our air traffic control. There, it was done on a very on a very gross basis, where each group would be allocated an altitude to fly at. All these things had to be sorted out, and originating at Bomber Command, but then coordinated with the bomber groups at the group headquarters. And by this time, the most important thing to get out to the stations was the bomb load, and that was the thing that was sorted out as priority number one. Because there were not only the bombs themselves, there were the question of how many were to be delayed fuses, and were they to be 24-hour, 48-hour, 7-hour, 7-day delay fuses, and incendiaries. Because in the bomb dumps, all the bombs had to be fused in accordance with the instructions that were coming out. The incendiaries were packed in cans, what we call cans. It was a form of a bomb rack, but it was in a form of a can. And these four, I can't remember how many there were to a can, but something like about, say, 100. Well, they all had to be packed into these things, and because it was there was an automatic release on the darn thing, and so it was a question of making sure they were packed properly so that when the button was pushed, they would fall free and not get hung up, which was a dreadful problem. Hang-up bombs was always a fear, and it happened quite often. So that had to get out, so the armors on the bases could start to put the bomb, to bomb up the airplane.
Yeah.
And this was even before they had anybody had any idea at the base what the target was. As a matter of fact, the target was kept under wraps until the very last minute. That was just about the last thing, and the route, that was about the last thing that was ever pushed out by group. Well, once the groups had coordinated with Bomber Command, then the group headquarters had to then do the same thing in more detail with each of their bases and with each of their squadrons and the number of air bombers that were going to come out from each one of those bases or each one of those squadrons. So they had to do the same thing. They had to take work all that out in detail, the route to be flown, and the timing of takeoff, and how one base, which would be further away from the target, would have to take off before one that was closer to the target, that sort of thing, depending on the route, again. Mm-hmm. But finally, all that would be sorted out. And then when the Air Officer Commanding was ready, as I say, this was always left as late as possible, he would then have a conference with the base commanders and the squadron commanders. Well, and he would say, all right, gentlemen, tonight the target is so-and-so. Now, as he was saying that, perhaps about 5 or 10 minutes before, the word would have gone out on the wires to the base, the target and the routes, so that, and it would, they would be literally waiting in the ops room at the stations, waiting to rip it off the machine, so to speak, and then immediately put it up on the map because in the ops room, because they knew that the Air Officer Commanding would be coming on in a few minutes, and the base commander and the squadron commanders would want to see, number one, what the target, number two, what the hell was the route.
Yeah.
So if they had any objections, that was the time for them to speak. Well, then what happened, then the AOC would then normally hand over the rest of the briefing to what was called the Air One, who was, suppose you'd call him the major, like in a brigade, it would be the major who does the ops planning in detail. And then he would then relate over the phone the briefing on target, the route, the defenses, night fighter tactics, altitude, any words of wisdom on weather, more importantly, weather on return, question of fuel consumption, if there was likely to be a weather problem, to make sure that they didn't race back. It was not, most crews, once they drop their bombs, like to get the hell out and get back over the English Channel as quickly as possible, so they'd push their airplanes. Well, like any other engine, the harder you pushed it, the greater your fuel consumption.
Yeah.
So the less you had when you got over base. And many airplanes crashed in England for that very reason, that the captain pushed his airplane to get back, and the net result was that he didn't have enough fuel when he ran into fog when he got back. All those things had to be written up into a briefing and hammered, and I mean hammered, at the squadron commanders and the base commanders, so that they in turn, when they briefed their crews, would pass on those words of wisdom, if you will, and in the hope that, that nothing... well, you're trying to save airplanes and lives. That's what you're trying to do. Do the job, but do it at the least cost, the lowest cost. Thank you. So anyway, that, I think, really was a sort of the organization, and very simply how the system worked when a raid was laid on. And, of course, in those early days, when that first raid on Berlin, I had no idea about what the hell the opera organization was. I was still very much in a daze. Everything was so new. Every time I turned around, it was something new. Every time anybody opened their mouth, I was learning. And you had to learn as quickly as possible.
Was there a problem at all because of your rank, having a pilot?
No. The principle of the captain or the pilot captain being the captain of the ship was never questioned. No, it was always that. And as a matter of fact, most crews were on a first name basis. It didn't make any difference who the hell the person was. And the only time that there would be the rank became a formal thing was literally on parade or in a situation where there was a mixture of officers and other ranks, or in this case sergeant. But you didn't mix. You didn't mix in the mess, because the sergeant went to his mess and you went to yours. And the only time you actually saw each other was when you were in the flight line, in the flight office, flying, or if you should have a crew party, by a crew party. And this was very common. Crews always stuck together. And if it was a night off, they'd say, okay, let's go to the local pub, or let's go into York and have a few beers in town. Well, you tried to go as a crew, and this was, and again, it was always on a first-name basis. So there was never any problem in that respect. But that first briefing, I don't remember. Again, I'm sure it was because I was in such a daze, and here I was going to go on my first operation, and this was it. Reached the crunch point. No turning back now. This was it.
Well, before you go on it, Reg, let me ask you one or two questions. Not particularly with this first trip, but as a rule, how accurate did you find the senior briefing with respect to A, weather, and B, enemy defenses?
Enemy defenses were quite good. It wasn't too off. Talk about ACAC, anti-aircraft guns. The night fighter problem is one that really evolved a little later in the war and became a terrible, terrible problem. With no real way of guessing or estimating what was going to happen, because you had no way of judging how the German night fighter controllers were going to react to any given raid.
Mm.
And if they were good, if they guessed right, it was chaos. If they guessed wrong, the raid went like a bomb. So the only other thing then you worried about were the ACAC defenses,
mm-hmm.
and the anti-aircraft defenses were well known. They didn't move them around that much. All they did was keep adding to them. And, we knew how many guns were around every target. This was always done and had been built up through intelligence, through photo interpretation. Spitfires would go out a little later and take photographs and bring them back. So we knew exactly what the hell was there.
Yeah.
Weather, though, oh, no. Weather was terrible. If anything, Bomber Command, the Commander-in-Chief, probably leaned towards avoiding an error in Met. If he felt that the Met situation was dicey, he would probably not lay on a raid. Because the risk was enormous. And again, as happened on a couple of occasions later in the war, when the Met men were wrong, grossly wrong. In other words, a very major gross error. It was a disaster. There was one raid when we had nearly 100 bombers crashed in England when we got back because there was no place to go. It was fog all over the place.
Oh,
solid
yeah.
fog.
So you had to figure not only the weather over the target, but the weather...
The weather on return was even actually... was really more important. Far more important than the weather over the target. Not from a point of view of survival. The weather over the target... if the weather was sour, well, you didn't have any great navigation aids in those days, so you just dropped your bombs on your estimated time of arrival. So you were over the target, and you just opened the bomb doors and pushed the button, and the bombs fell. You have no idea where the hell you were. None. Because the navigation aids weren't literally, there weren't any. The only you had was astro, and if you were over cloud, your astro navigation was your only means of knowing where the hell you were. You had no idea what was happening to the winds.
What about the German radio stations?
Negative. No, the Germans had, of course, what stations they were on, they had the old business, as they did in England, of constantly flipping to various transmitters. So you never knew what transmitter was broadcasting at any one particular moment. So, though, you couldn't count on anything there.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. If you did, I think you'd probably get yourself into trouble. So it was a question of very much hit or miss.
Mm-hmm.
So the forecasting on weather was, I suppose, in the main, it was accurate about 50% of the time, which was not bad batting in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think of the times when the Commander-in-Chief said, we don't go tonight because the weather's a little dicey, I sometimes wonder if he had pushed, if he had stuck his neck out or taken the risk, then that figure would have been a hell of a lot different, because there were many occasions when it looked as if we might have gone and we didn't, when the weather went very, very bad indeed. In other words, the forecast would have been a very sour one.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have pushed up the inaccuracy percentage quite a bit.
Yeah.
But it was not much fun, I can tell you, with the weather. Particularly in the wintertime, we were in Yorkshire, and all the airfields in Yorkshire, at least in the ones that were in four group in those days, were all in what called the Vale of York, which really was almost a valley. So you had hills around, and again, coming back, there were no real great letdown aids or anything like that in those days. Nothing like the technology that we have today. And a lot of crews would start to let down through the cloud and, of course, plow into the hills. So you had a lot of casualties that way with bad weather. So these were just, I suppose, the learning process.
Yeah.
By the end of the war, a lot of these things had changed, of course. A hell of a lot of them changed.
Well, now, again, at this early stage, what about intercommunication within the flight and squadron? And intercommunication between the squadron leaving the base and coming back.
Yeah. Well, there was, of course, RT silence. There was no broadcasting, no use of radio at all when the raid was mounted. Radio silence was very important. It was overplayed because, of course, the Germans, as soon as there was a very quiet day, morning or afternoon, no radio and nothing in the evening, the Germans knew bloody well there was a raid coming. Just because everything was too quiet.
Yeah.
When you taxied out, everything was done by the clock, by the watch. You knew what your takeoff time was, because in the ops room, all the aircraft numbers and the pilots, so the captains of the airplane, were listed, and takeoff time was listed, so you knew in what order you would take off. And then you knew, from that, you would work back, and you knew when to start your engines, because you knew how long it would take your engines to warm up, how long it would take to do your run-up and taxi out to the end of the runway, and then be there for your takeoff time. And it was the green light, the Aldous lamp, that gave you your green light. Now, if there was a cancellation, and it was not infrequent, that Bombing Command would lay on a raid, and then the weather would deteriorate after the morning forecast. And by early afternoon or late afternoon, the weather would have deteriorated to the point where the commander-in-chief would have to make the decision to cancel the raid. And it happened to me more than a few times when we were actually in our airplanes and taxiing to the takeoff point when a flare, a Berry pistol shot, would be fired from the control tower. And that would be the color would indicate, would tell us that the raid had been canceled. So we would just simply taxi back to our dispersal points and shut down, and that would be it. Again, no radio. Now, once you got airborne and away, and you crossed the coast, then, of course, you had a wireless operator on board, which was straight WT, and he would then start to operate, and he was your contact with your group. He would work the group signal base, if you will, through straight da 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 da.
Is that right?
Oh yes, all done in Morse code, all Morse code.
Well, this was to change later.
No, because you see, we never did that get beyond, even our radio in those days, we didn't have VHF. It was all the longer frequencies, and the old wireless sets were pretty thin around the edges in those days. So it was about, I can't remember exactly when, but it was not, in those first days we did not have VHF. That came in a little later. Of course, we never did get UHF. So that was a post-war development. But the control, or the reports, progress reports, and the one that was always probably the most important was a signal that you had bombed the target and were heading home. That was a message that was sent out by the wireless operator. And then if group had a problem, let's say for the sake of argument, the weather was deteriorating, fog was coming in, in one particular area, one group's area, but other areas were okay, then the group would send out a message to all the bombers in that group to divert to certain airfields. In other words, the group headquarters operational staff, control staff, would be sorting out, now where are we going to allocate our bombers? Where are they to go? And then very rapidly, the WT people would be sending out messages to the airplanes, telling them where to divert to. In other words, a straight weather diversion.
Yeah. In other words, select a different target.
No. This is on the way home. Where to land?
I see.
Not a question of attacking the target. No, where to go back in England, because the weather at the home base was deteriorating at a fast rate.
Well, what about a situation where you came to an appointed target, or even, getting close to it, 50 miles, 25 miles, and you see the weather is absolutely foul and there's no chance of even seeing your target. Could you be diverted to a different target?
We were given secondary targets, but it was never, was a successful policy. Normally the secondary target was quite close to the primary one, and if the primary one was covered with cloud, the chances are 99 out of 100 that the secondary was also covered. No, the weather over the target was, in those early days, without navigation aids, it was our bonding aids. It was a simple matter of when you reached your ETA, as long as you knew you were over Germany, then you just dropped your bomb. You had no idea where they were going to land. You had no way. If there was any chance of you being over France, you did not drop your bombs, or if you had to, because of fuel problems, consumption, or you'd lost an engine, then you always dropped your bombs safe. In other words, they were not fused. They would just go straight in the ground and would not explode. Policy of not dropping live bombs over occupied territory.
Yep.
And that was policy right throughout the war.
Yep.
You never dropped live bombs over, wildly, over France. Because
yep.
we did have targets in France, which were laid on, mm-hmm. of course, and we did hit. But if you were in trouble and you wanted to dump your bombs, you never dumped them live.
Yep.
They were always dropped in a safe condition.
Yep.
In other words, they were not fused. And the way the bomb was fused was very simple. in the nose of the bomb, there was a little tiny spinner.
Yep.
And then there was a safety, it was just a simply safety wire that went into the nose of the bomb and kept that spinner from spinning. Part of the fusing was where the little wire came up, it had a little catch, and part of the routine for the bomb aimer was to fuse the bomb, and a switch would then mean that the wire was locked.
Mm-hmm.
And when the bombs dropped, of course, the wire then pulled out from the fuse, and then the spinner would go around, and within a matter of a few seconds, the bomb was then fused and
nice.
Would go off. If you drop them safe, or you did not throw that switch, then the wire would go with the bomb.
Yeah.
And of course the spinner never would turn.
Yeah.
And so the bomb never would be fused, and the detonator would never be activated, and the chances of the bomb going off without the detonator were very, very slight.
Yeah.
So most of them just buried in the ground. With incendiaries, it was more difficult, terribly more difficult. But an incendiary, a 4-pound incendiary, all it did was start a fire. And the chances were 10-1 you drop them in fields anyway. But if you were anywhere near, if you were near a village, you might cause a fire, but the chance of killing someone was pretty low. But a bomb in a village would kill a lot.
Yeah, true enough. True enough.
I think that pretty well. So it gives you the background on how these raids were mounted. There was great tension, always great tension at a station. Well, all through the organization, there was tension in group and headquarters. There was tension at the bases because the psychological effect on everyone was pretty intense. It was another raid. We always lost somebody. There were very, very few raids during the war when somebody wasn't shot down or lost. There was a question of even getting airborne, taking off. The chances of a crash on takeoff were always there, and it happened, again, not infrequently, where somebody would try to lift off a little too soon, or he'd lose power on one of his engines just as he was rolling down, and too late to stop the airplane. He would be too far down the runway and not enough power to get the airplane airborne, because you were always riding right on the edge of the all-up weight of the airplane in relation to the power that you had and the length of the runway, when there were only 2,000-foot runways in those days, or the grass field, which was even worse. And there was always, everyone sort of held their breath when you were rolling down the runway until you had flying speed. And you got to that point where if you did lose an engine, you had a chance of staying in the air. You would retain control of the airplane, and you could at least keep flying long enough to get rid of your bombs. The first thing you had to do was dump your bombs. But if your airspeed was critical, just the mere fact of opening the bomb doors increased your drag enormously, and your airspeed would fall off several knots or several mph. And you could stall that way. So it was a very, very critical period, that rolling down the runway and getting airborne. And everyone heaved a sigh of relief when you got above about 1,000 feet, because then you felt that if anything happened, you were under control. But up until that point, anything going wrong, you were in deep, deep trouble. So the tension was it was enormous. Even at group headquarters, where all the airplanes that the group had committed to the raid were all up on the operational boards in the ops room, and with the time of takeoff listed, because that would have been reported back from the station to the group, and then the ops room staff, as the reports came in, and they would come in over the telephone, B. Baker, airborne at such and such a time. Well, this would be just marked up on the board so that the commander, the air officer commanding, and the ops room staff could see how the takeoff was going. And again, the tension, just the sigh of relief that used to come from the dais in the ops room when they were all airborne and you knew enough minutes had gone by and that they were all up to a point where the chances of a crash were pretty slim. Then there'd just be a great big sigh of relief. They're all off. And so you're over hurdle number one. Even the group, even though they were not themselves actually on the raid. And the same thing happened at the base. The base commander would just be on pins and needles until that same point had been reached.
Now, what is the relationship between the base commander and, shall we say, the squadron leader or group commander or whatever?
No, the squadron commander.
Yeah.
You had your group commander who was an air vice marshal. Then you went down to the base. The base commander was group captain, or equivalent of full colonel, group captain. And your squadron commanders were wing commanders, or lieutenant colonels. Mm-hmm. And then in the squadron, you had flights, mm-hmm. and the flights were majors. And that was it. Now, on a base, it was the normal organization was two squadrons on a base. Mm-hmm. The base commander normally did not go on operations. He was, again, normally a screened pilot, someone who had done operations, had done his tour of operations, mm-hmm. been promoted, and was now responsible for the administration of the base as well as the overall operational support of the base. Mm-hmm. The squadron commander was responsible for the operational efficiency of his own squadron, but he had in those days his own ground crew. In other words, they were a self-contained unit in the sense of maintenance and operations. But the base provided all the support that mm-hmm. he needed to get those airplanes into the air. He had only sufficient ground crew to do what we call first-line maintenance. Mm-hmm. If it was a major maintenance job, an engine change, severely damaged airplane requiring some component replacement, a modification program, a retrofit program, when they were constantly coming out, then they would go into the base maintenance organization, which was controlled by the base commander. In other words, his job was to provide the squadron commanders with everything they needed so they could do their damn job, mm-hmm. as well as run the base.
Yeah.
But being an experienced operational man himself, this was never any problem. Many of the squadron the base commanders did sneak off on raids, but they in the main were running contrary to the policy.
Mm-hmm.
Bomber Command, even in those days, Bomber Command losses were not insignificant, and they were trying to expand the command, so experience was terribly important.
Yeah.
From a training point of view. And thus, while some of these people objected strenuously to being grounded, which is the word that was screened, I mean, it's really the correct phrase, screened, meaning you were not to go on any more operations, many of them took that rather personally, but they never could accept the fact that it was done as a deliberate matter of policy to ensure that there were enough people around to carry pass on this experience. And at a briefing before a raid, after the squadron commander had finished his briefing, the base commander would always say something. And he quite often, very often in fact, would pick up something that he thought the squadron commanders had missed in their briefings and would home in on it. Or if he felt that something needed to be particularly stressed on this particular raid, always primarily related to the safety of getting the crews back, that sort of thing, assuming that they would do their job, then he would hammer that. And in other words, and the crews listened to the base commander. After all, he was the group captain, and he'd had experience, and he was the words of wisdom, so to speak,
yeah.
Not the hotshot squadron commander who
could
be a relatively young man. They were always older, those. It seemed they were always older,
yeah.
Anyway.
25 or 26.
No. In fact, in those days, they were actually much older than that. I can remember our base commander. God, he must have been at least 30. And but of course, most of those were pre-war RAF people.
Yeah,
they hadn't. The war hadn't gone long. Hadn't been on long enough for them to reach that rank level at that particular time. Not to happen later, because although there had been the casualties were. As I say, there were a number of casualties. They were not that severe. We hadn't really reached the real heavy chop period, which was to come later in the war, when promotions were extremely rapid.
Yeah.
Because it was a matter of survival. If you survived, you were promoted, period.
Yeah.
It was a question of necessity.
Yeah.
If you were going to have experienced people in those senior positions, you promoted them as fast as the other ones disappeared. And they were disappearing. If you survived, you were promoted. Well, assuming you had a modicum of common sense about you and you knew your job, then you were promoted. I don't mean it was just a straight case of promotion because you survived.
Yeah.
But
you're down, you're colonel.
That's right. The key was, of course, the experience of the people who did survive.
Yeah.
And it was very important for passing on. Well, as I've been talking about the tension, the psychological effect on the base, and it was tough. On the base, before the raid, the crews, of course, would know there was a raid was on. And what happened was that you had a meal before you left. Now, if it was a very late departure, and some of our departures wouldn't take place until midnight, then you would have what we would describe as a very late supper. You would have something to eat because you're going to be up all night.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a dusk takeoff, then you would have either an early or a late lunch, depending how the timing went. And it was always a fairly good, substantial meal you had because you could be away many hours. And all you had on board were what they call flight rations, and they normally consisted of some pretty soggy sandwiches and a thermos of coffee, and that was it. And it was always frozen, probably. Bloody sandwiches would be frozen because there was not much in the way of heat on board these airplanes. Yeah. Very little, in fact. And the navigators were always called into the briefing room about half an hour to, depending on the raid, even an hour before the rest of the crews came in, because they had to prepare their charts. They had to prepare the route. They had to work out the times. In other words, they had to get their navigation log ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they had to have the time to do that. So they would go in first, and then...